Picture a 10-year-old girl nailing every move at cheerleading tryouts. Perfect splits, flawless rhythm, smile blazing with confidence. She walks off that gym floor knowing she crushed it. Days later, the list goes up. Only white names. A classmate delivers the final blow. They don't accept monkeys like you on the team. That moment, when you realize your skill doesn't matter because your humanity is in question, becomes a defining wound. But here's what makes this story different. That girl didn't shrink. She weaponized her excellence, carrying it like armor into every white space that never wanted her there. This is the fierce heartbeat of This Will Be My Undoing, where personal pain transforms into cultural analysis, and one woman's refusal to be diminished becomes a blueprint for resistance. At 3 years old, chemicals strong enough to unclog drains touched my scalp. The relaxer started cool, then seared, a pain I'd endure every 6 weeks for the next decade. While white girls debated lip gloss shades, black girls scrutinized each other's hair texture, length, authenticity. We absorbed an unspoken hierarchy. Straight meant acceptable, kinky meant problematic. Schools still ban afros and braids as distracting. Employers deem natural hair unprofessional. When we chemically alter what grows from our scalps, we're negotiating survival in spaces built on white standards. I quit relaxers at 15. My hair broke off dramatically. I hid the damage under braids and wigs, never satisfied because I couldn't accept what was naturally mine. Then Rachel Dolezal happened, a white woman masquerading as black while actual black women can't choose whether society sees us. She forced an uncomfortable question. What defines black womanhood when our features are celebrated only when not attached to our bodies? The answer isn't in hair texture or skin tone. It's in the lived experience of navigating a world that simultaneously fetishizes and devalues everything we are. Princeton was supposed to be where I'd find love. Instead, I became invisible. Black women outnumbered black men 3-1, and despite joining the right organizations, nothing changed. When a black football player asked me to help rank Princeton's most attractive black women, my name didn't make the list. After being stood up repeatedly, I wondered if my voice was the problem. The black women who attracted attention seemed quieter, less opinionated. So when Bradley, a childhood friend, offered an all-expenses-paid trip to Nevada, I didn't hesitate. I was 22, had never been kissed during 4 years at an Ivy League school, and desperate to feel wanted. He expected sex. I offered everything but. Not from desire, from obligation. We declared love across the distance. I got birth control, ready to lose my virginity on the next visit. Then he confessed. He wasn't ready for exclusivity. He wanted to travel, sleep with other women, keep me as an option. The rejection shattered me, but the real tragedy was how I'd internalized the belief that speaking my mind made me unlovable. When my stepfather's dementia turned our home into a danger zone, nearly burning down the house, forcing me to develop obsessive checking rituals, I refused therapy. Black people don't do therapy, I told myself, despite my stepfather being a psychologist. I justified this with history, medical experiments on enslaved women, Henrietta Lacks' stolen cells, centuries of violation. But the real reason ran deeper. I'd absorbed the strong black woman mythology, the belief that we must endure everything without complaint, never show weakness. This image appears complimentary. It's actually dehumanizing, denying our vulnerabilities and our right to break down. The Black Girl Magic movement tried to reclaim this narrative, celebrating Beyoncé, Simone Biles, Michelle Obama. But magic implies something supernatural, not the very human struggle of navigating a world designed to undermine us. My religious mother surprised me by suggesting therapy months before my stepfather died. She made the appointment, offered to sit with me. Initially, I fidgeted, uncomfortable. Then something shifted, weights lifted. I finally had space to discuss feeling weak without shame. As a black woman at Princeton, I'd felt pressured to maintain perfection in a space never meant for people like me. My therapist helped me restructure my thinking without challenging my faith. The compulsions faded. I learned that strength isn't about never breaking. It's about having the courage to acknowledge when you're breaking and asking for help. In St. Petersburg, Russians stared with unblinking surveillance, not attraction, but assessment. With limited Russian vocabulary, I couldn't confront this. A man followed me from the metro. I slipped between passengers to escape. At a bar, a drunk Russian pinned me against a wall. Later, we encountered skinheads. I grabbed my friend and fled, while our white Edinburgh companion stayed behind, even joining in Nazi salutes they later claimed was from fear, though their giggles suggested it was just another wild story they could afford because they were white. I knew Zambian students had been beaten here, a Senegalese student shot dead. Back in Harlem, I felt equally displaced. I'd never lived in a predominantly black space before. Growing up, I was taught not to embarrass my mother in white spaces. Dialect modulated, gestures moderated, voice quieted, hair tamed. But in Harlem, I felt unprepared, closer to my white gay Republican roommate than to my neighbors. We bonded over literature and discussed gentrification. He believed neither of us would be living there without it. I wondered if I, college-educated and upwardly mobile, was as much a gentrifier as he was. This realization broke something open. I'd always used white behavior as my reference point. I didn't know how to exist authentically in a black space because I'd spent my entire life performing for white approval. The danger in Russia was external and obvious. The danger in Harlem was internal. The recognition that white supremacy had colonized even my sense of self. When Beyoncé released Lemonade, I watched for an assignment and found myself broken open by its raw exploration of heartbreak and grief. I mourned relationships I'd never had, sons I'd never birthed, marriages I'd never entered. On Twitter that night, Black women filled a reservoir of emotions we'd never fully articulated but felt deeply. Beyoncé had awakened something dormant. Lemonade wasn't about uplifting Black people generally, but Black women specifically. Contrast this with Girlhood, a French film about Mariem, a 16-year-old Black girl in a poor Parisian suburb. Despite its brilliance, director Celine Sciamma, a white middle-class woman, claimed it wasn't about race, but was universal. She based it on observations of Black girls in shopping centers without speaking to them. Sciamma's insistence on universality reveals how whiteness assumes itself as the center of any experience. When white voices dominate narratives about Black experiences, they center themselves, making our stories about their enlightenment rather than our lived reality. The publishing industry's tokenism forces Black women writers to compete for limited opportunities. Established writers sometimes withhold mentorship, unreturned emails, deflected requests, guardedness that perpetuates isolation. I've experienced this rejection and caught myself struggling with comparison when another Black woman's success triggered my insecurity. I refuse to perpetuate this cycle. I respond to emerging Black female writers within 48 hours, maintain an open-door policy for sharing contacts, and actively work against the scarcity mindset that white supremacy cultivates among us. This requires constant vigilance against seeing other Black women as competition rather than collaborators. That 10-year-old girl who didn't make the cheerleading squad carried her rejection into Princeton, into publishing, into every space that tried to diminish her. She transformed that pain into fuel, disrupting spaces traditionally closed to Black women. It was not only our presence that made them mad, but our excellence. This was their nightmare and my joy. Your existence as a Black woman in spaces that never wanted you is already resistance. True revolution happens when you refuse to internalize their limitations, extend the ladder to others behind you, and transform individual excellence into collective power. The world will try to make you compete with other Black women for scraps. Choose solidarity instead. Your voice, loud, opinionated, unfiltered, is exactly what the world needs to hear.